today is Wednesday, April 12th. We're going to wrap up information on the autonomic nervous system, and then we're going to spend the remainder of our time doing exam 4 review. Okay, so we're reviewing old brain stuff first. Just want to make sure we hit this one more time. I hope that by Monday your comfort level's really hitting it with this stuff. Let's talk about the 4 main regions of your cerebrum. There are frontal lobe, on the sides we have temporal lobe, near the top side we have what lobe? Parietal, good. And at the back side? Occipital, good. Can you tell me which lobe houses visual information?
Occipital,
good. There is a primary visual cortex and an association area. Which one of those is first to receive the visual information from your eyes? Primary, good. So the primary area receives the visual info. What processes and interprets that visual information? Association area, good. Okay, let's see. Can you tell me which lobe houses hearing? Temporal lobe, good. And again, which specific portion is the first to receive the hearing information? Primary, good. And the association area does what? Interprets, good. Let's see, can you tell me which lobe houses voluntary motor control? Frontal lobe, yeah. And it's in a specific ridge of tissue right here in front of that central gyrus, or sulcus rather, and that ridge is called the precentral gyrus. So the precentral gyrus houses something called the motor cortex. So can you give me an example of how that motor cortex would work? Is this for moving voluntary, involuntary, or subconscious motor control?
Voluntary.
Voluntary, good. So would this be contracting the heart, moving smooth muscle, or moving skeletal muscle?
Skeletal,
good. So an example would be perhaps deciding to move your arm to write something down. That voluntary movement originates in the precentral gyrus of which lobe? Frontal lobe, good. So precentral gyrus of the frontal lobe. Okay, right through there. Let's see, right next to it is another gyrus. This one's called the postcentral gyrus, but this one happens to be in a different lobe. Which lobe? Good. And what is housed in the postcentral gyrus? Good. Somatic sensory. Good. That is somatic sensory. And that somatic sensory cortex is the first area to receive information from your body. So what are some of the types of things that your somatic sensory cortex might sense? Touch, temperature, pressure, good. So the kinds of things that don't relate to your head, you know, sight, vision, hearing, taste, and smell, we're not talking about those things. We're talking about what you feel. Touch, temperature, pressure, those kinds of bits of sensory info travel to your somatic sensory cortex. As a prefix, the word somatic means body, so we're talking about the body senses that are coming up through your ascending tracts of your spinal cord. Let's see, can you tell me in which lobe, or which, let's do it this way, which hemisphere typically houses the speech center? Left, yeah, left center, left hemisphere typically houses your speech center. Most of us have it over here on the left side of our brains, not the right side. All right, so thinking about that frontal lobe, can you tell me the function or purpose of that prefrontal cortex?
Personality,
good. Decorum. Toilet training, good. So who we believe we are as a person is housed there on that prefrontal cortex. Okay, a couple of oddballs here. Taste and smell, they are not housed together in the same lobe. So you'll notice that smell is in the temporal lobe, and where is taste?
Parietal
lobe, good. So slightly different locations for those two, even though they're very closely associated senses. All right, so let's talk about the inside of the brain, all those deep pieces. Let's get you a different picture to look at. Okay, so let's talk about the cerebellum at the back of the brain. Can you tell me a couple of jobs that it does? Balance, good. skeletal muscle coordination, so that helps with your balance, okay? And so this piece of brain tissue coordinates with your inner ear. This is something we'll discuss a little bit later on. Let's talk about the diencephalon. Let's hit the hypothalamus first. What are some of the main jobs of your hypothalamus? Homeostasis, good. So we control hunger, thirst. What else is controlled here?
Body temperature.
Sleep-wake cycles, good, good. This is also home to our autonomic nervous system, the one that's involuntary or automatically controlled. And this one also is kind of the control center for our emotions that route through our limbic system. So we're looking at a lot of controls here that have to do with homeostasis, just basic survival skills. Okay, let's talk about the thalamus, which is nearby. The thalamus sits above the hypothalamus. Hypo, of course, is below. So what is a major job of your thalamus? Relay station, good. So it routes important sensory information up to the appropriate portions of your brain. So the ascending tracts that travel your spinal cord come through the thalamus. The thalamus then relays the appropriate senses to the right parts of your brain, or the left parts as it may be. So that relay station there is housed in the thalamus. All right, and the last part of our diencephalon is called the pituitary gland. This pituitary gland has one big job. What is it? Endocrine system, good. They oftentimes call it the master endocrine gland because it is so involved in controlling your body's hormones. But we're going to talk about all the parts in BIO211 that it controls. So really important part of your brain here, in fact, being an endocrine gland. Let's talk brainstem, where a lot of the vital functions are housed. We know the brainstem has the pons, medulla, and midbrain. So let's take the medulla first. It houses four different types of control centers. One is called the cardiovascular center that controls heart rate. What are some of the other control centers housed here?
Respiratory.
Emetic, good. And vasomotor, good. Now, the medulla actually has no blood-brain barrier, along with which other piece of brain tissue? Where's homeostasis control? There you go, hypothalamus. So medulla and hypothalamus have no blood-brain barrier, and that's because their main jobs are controlling things like homeostasis. We know the pons has one major job, and that's to help control breathing. So it does, in fact, work with the respiratory center housed in the medulla. And then finally, the midbrain is a piece of the brainstem, and it's a reflex center for what two senses? Visual and auditory, good. So that midbrain is a reflex center, works with visual and auditory stimuli. Okay, how you doing with all these parts of the brain? It's a lot, yeah. Yeah. I think working through pictures and just kind of flashcarding yourself through it can be a good way to get to stick. Yeah. Any parts that I can help you with? Anything I can go back and review for you here? Okay, why don't we talk about today's material and wrap up our current chapter? That's chapter 14. We were on page 122 in class on Monday. So I just want to repeat the information we covered on Monday about the autonomic and somatic nervous systems. These are both control systems. The aspect we're taking right now is as a control system. And so we're looking at them being motor output subdivisions. So we're going to follow specifically the autonomic division right now and talk about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. We talked about the somatic system on Monday. What does it primarily control? Voluntary or involuntary events? Voluntary, good. So what types of muscles are controlled by way of the somatic nervous system? Skeletal, good. Since we're talking about autonomic nervous system, we're talking about involuntary events and the control of what types of muscles? Yes, smooth and cardiac, good. And we can also put into that category glands and organs, since they're also under involuntary control, things like sweat glands, organs like the stomach or the pancreas. So we're going to work on motor control being in two divisions, sympathetic and parasympathetic. So what types of activities would force your body into a sympathetic mode?
Exercise.
Exercise, good. What else?
Emergency,
right? Fight or flight, yeah. Excitement, emergency, exercise. So these kinds of activities will put you into fight or flight mode, known as the sympathetic nervous system's division. So when we think about this division, we think about certain results. We think about increased alertness and mental activity. We have an increase in metabolism. What happens to your heart rate when you're really excited? Goes up, good. And blood pressure does too. They both go up together. And then our breathing passageways will dilate. How does that help you if you're in fight or flight mode? Get oxygen in, yeah. That way you can get more oxygen to those cells to make what? ATP, good. So during fight or flight mode, we break down our fat reserves for energy. We activate our sweat glands to release sweat to cool our bodies down. And we actually decrease digestive and urinary function. So there's really no need for having digestion and urination taking away energy reserves from the rest of the body that really needs it during the survival mode. So sympathetic nervous system involves the response of several sets of nerves along the spinal cord. Are the cranial, thoracic, lumbar, or sacral nerves involved in sympathetic nervous system response? Thoracic and lumbar, good. So thoracic and lumbar are in the gut area. They're in your chest and gut area. So what message is sent by way of those spinal nerves to the heart and lungs? Do we want them to increase their activity or decrease their activity? Increase. Yeah, if you're scared to death or if you're excited or having an emergency, increase the activity going to your heart and lungs. Increase heart rate, increase blood pressure, dilate those respiratory passageways. What message is going to your digestive and urinary organs?
Relax.
Relax, right. Take a back seat, relax, we'll get back to you. So those organs were told to kind of slow their activities, decrease their activities. We're going to put the blood and energy supplies into the thoracic cavity organs. So we've got one thing down pat. We know that the thoracic and lumbar spinal nerves that innervate our organs are going to take precedence when we're in sympathetic mode. Do these nerves have short or long preganglionic neurons? Short or long preganglionic neurons?
Short.
They're short, yeah. In this picture, they're colored red. The ganglion is close to the spinal cord, and we actually have long postganglionic neurons that travel way over here to our organs, okay? What are some of the neurotransmitters released during sympathetic response? Good, acetylcholine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. So we use epinephrine as a way to treat severe allergic response. Why do you think epinephrine is a suitable neurotransmitter to give someone who's had, say, a severe allergy to a bee sting? How does that help them? What will epinephrine tell your heart rate and
speeds up
your
heart rate, dilates the breathing.
Good. Speeds up heart rate, dilates breathing passageways. And one big problem with allergic reactions is swelling of those respiratory passageways. Now we've got a relationship here between sympathetic and epinephrine to see that epinephrine's going to make those breathing passageways get bigger. They're going to dilate and open up. Okay. So sympathetic nervous system is called our fight or flight system. It's the emergency response system. It also happens to operate or dominate during exercise and excitement. Let's take the parasympathetic by contrast. What kinds of activities or events put this system in control?
Digestion.
Yep, digestion.
Defecation.
Diuresis. So if you're eating, if you're pooping, if you're peeing, these are all activities that force the parasympathetic nervous system to be in control. So normally we like to be in a restful frame of mind when we're performing these activities. You know, nobody wants to have an excitement or an emergency occur during a bowel movement. You know, no one wants to be eating and having, you know, a circus taking place in their lap. So we want to be in a restful frame of mind and have the parasympathetic nervous system in control during our rest and digest activities. So this time, what do we tell the heart and lungs and blood pressure to do?
Relax.
Yeah. Heart rate decreases, blood pressure decreases, breathing passageways constrict. We no longer need so much oxygen going to our cells and tissues. But this time, what do we tell our digestive organs and urinary organs? Yep, speed up, increase your activities. So we have flip-flopped the control here. During parasympathetic control, we favor activities below the diaphragm. And during sympathetic activity, we favor control going above the diaphragm. So we've just placed the control now back down to the digestion, diuresis, defecation activities. Okay? So in this instance, we're looking at, let me get you a picture. We're looking at cranial nerves and what are the nerves controlling your body's activities? Sacral, good. So cranial nerves and sacral nerves are gonna place control over your body's activities. You've probably heard the phrase mind over matter, and that's what's gonna happen here. We're gonna calm our bodies down. We're gonna force control to go to the digestive organs, and the heart and the lungs are gonna take a back seat in terms of excitement right now. So this time, what about the length of our preganglionic neurons? Are they long or short?
No.
They are long, good. Our postganglionic neurons have what type of neuron?
Short,
right. So this time the ganglion, or collection of cell bodies, sits closer to our organs that we're innervating. Okay, so that kind of wraps up where we were on Monday. That is page 122. Do you have any questions on that page? Anything I can clarify for you? Okay. Okay, so just one thing to consider here, the neurotransmitters that work for each system. Which system does epinephrine and norepinephrine only work for?
Sympathetic,
good. And then notice acetylcholine does both systems. It works for both the sympathetic and the parasympathetic system. So we need to talk about the effects that acetylcholine has depending on which system it's working for. Okay? And so that actually takes us over to page 123. And we're going to talk about different kinds of receptors. Okay, so receptors are classified based on the type of neurotransmitter they bind. And if receptors bind epinephrine and norepinephrine, we call them adrenergic receptors. I do need to mention the fact that epinephrine is alternately called adrenaline, and its buddy, norepinephrine, is sometimes called noradrenaline. Now, they will sometimes abbreviate epinephrine as epi, they'll sometimes abbreviate norepinephrine as NE. These two are a tag team. They work with the same effects. So you oftentimes hear us talk about them as synergists. Okay, so epinephrine and norepinephrine, alternately called adrenaline and noradrenaline, they are a tag team that perform the same job. They have the same effects. There are two types of receptors that bind epinephrine and norepinephrine. They're called alpha receptors and beta receptors. So, you know, when they're naming this stuff, it looks like they were starting alphabetically with A, then B. And you think, okay, they've got a good trend going on here. And then you would expect letters C and D down here for cholinergic, but they completely switched gears. And you'll notice that these cholinergic receptors that bind acetylcholine are actually called nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. So they're not alphabetical, of course, but the issue here is they've named them after the type of ingredient that binds those receptors. I know you've heard of nicotine before. What products contain it? Yeah, tobacco, cigarettes. So that's how they discovered the nicotinic receptors. And the muscarinic receptors were discovered in mushrooms called muscarines. So there's where the naming system comes from for the cholinergic receptors. So let me emphasize, adrenergic receptor means it binds adrenaline. Adrenaline is epinephrine, okay? And choline in cholinergic comes from the word acetylcholine. So keep those clues in mind. Okay, are you so far so good? So let me kind of get your brain into thinking about how this stuff works. Way back when we talked about the plasma membrane, we talked about all these surface features on the outside, things like carbohydrate chains and glycoproteins and glycolipids. These surface features play a lot of roles. They have a lot of different functions, but some of these surface features act as receptors that bind neurotransmitters or even hormones that drift by. So that's kind of what we're thinking about right now, is some of these surface features here that can bind a specific neurotransmitter. This picture looked familiar. Okay, you've got your axon terminal up here. Down below is a neighboring cell. And in between is a gap of space called what? Synaptic cleft or synapse, good. And the way to communicate between cells is to let a neurotransmitter or a hormone, some kind of chemical messenger, travel across that synapse or through your interstitial fluids and then bind one of these surface feature receptors. So when we're looking at this picture, something like that glycoprotein, for instance, might be the receptor. So that's what we're looking at specifically here. You'll notice there's an alpha receptor sitting there and a beta receptor sitting there. So thinking back big picture, back here, alpha and beta receptors are types of adrenergic receptors. So what specific neurotransmitters do they bind? Good, epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, so let's work this through. During sympathetic control, which sets of organs get excited and speed up their activities? Heart and lungs or digestive and urinary?
Heart and lungs.
Heart and lungs, good. Notice that alpha receptors excite, beta receptors excite. Guess where they're located? Heart and lungs, that's right, because they work for the sympathetic nervous system and they're going to excite the heart and lungs, okay? You'll notice that alpha receptors can also inhibit. Well, if they're working for the sympathetic nervous system, we don't want to inhibit heart and lungs. What organs do we want to slow down? Urinary and digestive, right? So you've got alpha receptors on your urinary and digestive organs that will inhibit activity, slowing down those activities. Okay, makes sense. So when epinephrine or norepinephrine binds a beta receptor, then the beta receptor excites the cell. It actually increases the metabolism of our heart and our lungs. So specifically, those beta receptors are on our heart and they bind norepinephrine. So heart activity increases. Alpha receptors that are on the digestive organs will inhibit their activity. So when epinephrine binds them, the effect is to slow the activity of those organs. Alpha receptors that sit on your heart and lungs, however, are going to excite those organs. Now, these alpha receptors actually sit on calcium channels. So this is going back to our information in the muscle chapter. What happens if you let calcium into a cell? Yeah, if it's an axon terminal, it lets the neurotransmitter out. And what happens if you let calcium into a muscle cell?
It
excites it, yeah. So you're talking about troponin and tropomyosin change in shape. There's myosin heads forming cross bridges, pivoting and doing power strokes. So calcium inside a cell is going to excite the cell. And so that's what alpha's receptors sit on. They sit on calcium channels. Okay? Does this make sense so far? What if we don't want epinephrine to excite your heart? What kind of receptor might we have to block? Yeah, might have to block an alpha or a beta receptor. What if we don't want calcium to come into your heart? Now, which specific type do we have to block?
Alpha.
Alpha, yeah. Why alpha receptors?
Because it sits on a calcium channel.
Because it sits on a calcium channel, good. So if you have a patient who takes a calcium channel blocker, that patient is taking a medication called an alpha blocker. And if you block that receptor site right there, and you don't let epinephrine or norepinephrine bind to it, then calcium can't come in, and the cell doesn't get excited. So what do you think happens to the heart rate?
It slows down.
Yeah.
So that will be for somebody that's
had what?
Tachycardia.
Tachycardia, and specifically due to excess calcium. Yep.
Probably a lot of renal patients as well.
Right.
Because they keep the excess calcium and potassium.
Exactly. Yep. So if they test and they say, hey, you've got high calcium levels, that's the way to slow it down. Exactly. For those who take a beta blocker, what effect do you think that would have on heart rate?
Slow it down too,
right. These are two different drugs that have two different effects. You know, one blocks calcium from coming into the cell through an alpha channel. And if you take a beta blocker, then you're actually slowing the metabolism of the cell. I actually take a beta blocker. I have something called SVT, or supraventricular tachycardia.
My daughter has that.
Really? I think it's pretty common. Resting heart rate for me is like 95 beats per minute. So, you know, sometimes when you're sitting there, you feel your heart rate going blah, 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 running through your chest. So I take a beta blocker to slow me down to about a 75 beat per minute heart rate, which is more average or normal. So the beta blocker is meant to block the excitement that epinephrine, more specifically norepinephrine, brings to the heart. So it literally blocks norepinephrine from telling your heart to excite. So the really weird thing is, if something scares me or startles me, you know how you have that adrenaline rush, it kind of makes you tingle all over for just a moment? Okay, I don't have that. So I don't have the increased heart rate, I don't have the tingle that comes from being excited or scared. You expect the flood to come of epinephrine and norepinephrine, but you don't ever experience it. So it's kind of a weird thing to be on a beta blocker and have that surge blocked from your heart. Okay, so alpha receptors are on calcium channels. So when calcium comes in, it excites heart and lungs. Betas are on other channels, or on sodium channels actually, and that helps to regulate the metabolism of the cell. So slightly different operation here. The goal is the same, which is to excite your cells.
You said beta was on a sodium channel?
Beta's on sodium channels. So let's talk about the other two receptors. Let's go back to our big picture here. We know that cholinergic receptors bind acetylcholine. Keep in mind, acetylcholine works for both the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so what we have to keep in mind is that acetylcholine kind of plays both systems. The two kinds of receptors that bind acetylcholine are nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. So let's take a look at those nicotinic receptors first. You'll notice that when nicotinic receptors bind acetylcholine, ignore the word alpha there, that's a little confusing, but when these receptors bind acetylcholine, they open and sodium comes flooding into the cell. So when sodium comes flooding into a muscle cell, for instance, what happens to the muscle cell? It gets excited, yeah. So where do you think these nicotinic receptors primarily sit? Sodium channels, yeah. And if they're working for, say, the sympathetic nervous system, could be calcium, yeah, could be. And so they could work for sympathetic nervous system, or they could work for parasympathetic nervous system. So when they work for the parasympathetic nervous system, they increase activity of your digestive organs. They tell the smooth muscle there to get excited and to start working the food through, okay? So if they're working, however, for the parasympathetic nervous system, that's the activity that we expect to see with acetylcholine. Let's contrast that with the muscarinic receptors. Muscarinic receptors work only for your parasympathetic nervous system. So what effect does your parasympathetic nervous system have on your digestive and urinary organs? Excites them, good. So you'll notice that when acetylcholine binds a muscarinic receptor, the cell becomes excited. So we encourage food to be processed by your digestive organs, or we encourage urine to be processed and made by your urinary organs. So muscarinic receptors are the ones that work strictly for your parasympathetic system, and they're going to encourage digestive and urinary activities. Okay, so you'll notice there EPSP and IPSP are terms we've used before. When you're promoting an EPSP, are you exciting or making your cell stay at rest? Exciting your cell. An IPSP has what effect on a cell? Inhibits, yeah, puts that cell at rest. So when muscarinic receptors are stimulated by acetylcholine, they excite your digestive organs, and what organs do they put at rest? Heart and lungs, exactly. So you'll notice there, under parasympathetic control, we send IPSPs, or a rest message, to your heart and lungs. So I'd go ahead and give you a little sneak preview of Bio211. In Bio211, you're going to learn about the heart rate. Normal heart rate's around 75 beats per minute, although they consider a range of 60 to 100 to be, you know, an okay range. But nonetheless, the parasympathetic nervous system is the one that has primary control over your heart. So what effect do you think the parasympathetic nervous system is doing? Speeding you up or slowing your heart rate down? Slowing it down, good. So which neurotransmitter has that job to slow your heart rate down? Which neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine, yeah. So acetylcholine will slow your heart rate down. And which system is this working for? Parasympathetic, good. And that means you probably have what type of receptor sitting on your heart? Yep, sodium channels with muscarinic receptors, exactly. So if muscarinic receptors bind acetylcholine and their job is to slow the heart rate, what is the opposite receptor, called the beta receptor, doing to your heart rate? Speeding it up, yeah. So you've kind of got a battle here, don't you? You've got beta receptors binding epinephrine and norepinephrine, speeding heart rate on the heart, and then, of course, muscarinic receptors slowing the heart rate by binding acetylcholine, or ACH. So you've kind of got a battle here. You've got a set of antagonistic systems, sympathetic speeding heart, muscarinic receptors, and parasympathetic system slowing the heart rate. Okay, this is a really thick page of information. I think probably reading through it, listening to the recording a couple times will help make this click. But these words are so similar, and they come across as being related, and they are, and that can be very confusing when you're trying to study for this page. Anything that I can clarify for you so far on this page? Anything I can repeat or review?
The beta blocker, what happens to heart rate, like that?
Sure. Okay. So let's talk about medications, alpha blockers and beta blockers. Okay. So we know alpha and beta receptors are working for the sympathetic nervous system, and they will bind epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, alpha and beta receptors work for your sympathetic nervous system, and they bind epinephrine and norepinephrine. So if you want to block the action of epinephrine and norepinephrine on a particular organ, you have to use a drug that fits in like a puzzle piece to the receptor site and blocks that particular epinephrine or norepinephrine molecule from binding. So let's take the alpha receptors first. Alpha receptors sit on calcium channels, and when calcium channels are opened, that will excite a cell. Well, if that's your heart, we may not want to have it excited all the time. So an alpha blocker will sit in and block an alpha receptor, and that prevents epinephrine or norepinephrine from exciting your cell. So what is not let into the cell? The calcium. Yeah. Keep the calcium out. Don't let it come in and excite your cell. Okay? So alpha blockers lower heart rate by blocking calcium entry into a cell. Okay? Because, yeah, you block calcium's entry into the cell with an alpha blocker. Let's talk beta blockers. Beta blockers are also medications that block the receptor site. Beta blockers intend to lower the heart rate, so this medication sits in that receptor site and prevents any changes inside the cell. Specifically, it's going to slow the metabolism in the cell, so we prevent sodium from coming in and creating changes. So we have a calcium channel blocker that is an alpha blocker, and beta blockers slow the metabolic rate of our cells. The goal is the same. You know, we're going to slow the heart rate with either form of a blocker. It's how we get there. We block calcium entry through an alpha blocker. We technically slow the metabolic rate through a beta blocker. Yeah, going to your abdomen, and then you're trying to force it to the heart and lungs, and it doesn't know where to go. Yeah, exactly right. Just kind of as an interesting side note, you know, when people are put to sleep for surgery, oftentimes if it's major surgery, they'll give them a medication that makes them completely relaxed and paralyzed. And these kinds of drugs are called anticholinergic medications. These anticholinergic medications block either our nicotinic or muscarinic receptor sites. And so when acetylcholine comes along and tries to bind, it's not allowed to because the blocker is sitting in one of those locations. So as long as a person is receiving an anticholinergic medication, they're going to be paralyzed. Usually when the person is brought out of surgery, they give a drug that reverses the anticholinergic effects, and then they should be able to move and function again once they're out of surgery. So the interesting thing is you've heard all these movies about people being awake but paralyzed during surgery. It's like the worst horror nightmare, right? Mm-hmm. There's two medications at least that they'll give during surgery. They'll give you a paralysis drug, an anticholinergic medication to keep you from moving. And they also give you something to knock you out and make you loopy. So if the loopy drug doesn't work, but the paralysis drug does work, then you're laying there in somewhat of a semi-conscious state, unable to move. So you've heard these stories about people crying and they see a tear run down the face or doing something that can catch the attention of the operating staff. That's about the only way to overcome the effects of those anticholinergic drugs. So kind of an interesting thing there about, we've learned so much about how to manipulate medications. That's one thing that we know to do with medications during surgery is, you know, stop you from having those motions take effect. Okay. Any questions, anything else I can clear up or repeat for you on this page? completely lost you, or are you just taking it all in? Taking it all in, okay. Thankfully, the last page is really easy, so we'll go through that one. It's over on page 124. We've talked all this time about motor control and how to get the body to move or not to move. Let's talk about sensory input and completely switch gears. So here on page 124, when we're talking about sensory information is picked up by neurons in our skin, muscles, joints, and other places. Sometimes those sensory nerves have what are called free nerve endings. Okay? So if you think about your skin, you do have free nerve endings in your skin. Where else do you think you might have some free nerve endings? Tongue. You ever burn your tongue?
Yeah.
Awful, isn't it? A couple days later, you can taste again, finally. Okay? Or if you have a cold and you can't smell, you know, those osmoreceptors in your nose can grow back. So interesting, we normally think of nerves as not being able to regenerate, but in fact some can. The ones in your tongue, the ones in your nose have some capability of regenerating. So these are what we call free nerve endings. They don't have a lot of protection around them. Your eye, however, is very well protected, and it's what we call an encapsulated nerve. All that connective tissue that forms the front of your eyeball is meant to protect what's at the back where your retina is located. So eyeball is a great example of an encapsulated set of nerve endings. Let's talk about types of nerves. Nerves that are kind of picking up info from the outside of your body are called exteroceptors. So temperature would be a great example of an exteroceptor, a thermoreceptor. Where do interoceptors get their information from? Organs inside your body, okay, things like your joints. Proprioceptors are also inside the body. They do pick up on information specifically from a couple of locations, muscles and joints. So, you know, you can close your eyes and walk through your house in the dark and still be able to navigate pretty well without running into anything. And that's because your proprioceptors know where your body parts are in space, plus you've memorized the layout of your house. So when people are growing, you know, kids are clumsy, they got bruises all the time, that's because their proprioceptors are constantly having to adjust for a different sized body. You know, kids that grow 4 to 6 inches in a year are gonna have to adjust for having a body that's got proprioceptors that are constantly elongating in those joints. No wonder we're clumsy when we're kids. We're always having to adjust for a different body setup. All right, in terms of receptors, some sensory nerves are considered tonic while others are phasic. You'll notice that the tonic receptors are always actively conducting nerve impulses. They're always on. Pain receptors are always on. That's why we have all sorts of medications to block pain receptors, because you can't get the pain to go away as long as the receptors are being activated. Pain receptors are called nociceptors. Phasic receptors are the kinds that cut off after a while. So what about the receptors in your skin that tell your brain about the clothes you're wearing? Do you think they're tonic or phasic? They're phasic, yeah. You don't need to think about your clothes every minute of every day. What about the temperature in this room, as long as it stays stable, tonic or phasic? Phasic, yeah. They'll cut off if the temperature is the same. So we're not overwhelming your brain with information. These phasic receptors phase off after a while. That's why when somebody cooks a cake and it smells delicious and you walk in the house and you say, God, I gotta have that piece of cake, you don't smell it 5 minutes later. What type are they? They're phasic, yeah. So, you know, you may have heard that the first bite of a meal is the most intense flavor that you're gonna experience. As you continue eating, taste receptors also phase off to a bit, And so the meal doesn't taste as intense or good after 20 bites as it did for that very first bite. So you're constantly, you know, having to let those receptors kind of phase off and rest a little bit. So they adapt to their environment and they're no longer stimulated. Finally, let's classify our receptors by what they detect. What do nociceptors detect?
Pain.
Pain, good. Thermoreceptors are for temperature. Mechanoreceptors detect some kind of mechanical change in your body. Tactile receptors are in your skin. They detect pressure and vibrations, for instance. What do baroreceptors detect?
Pressure,
good. Got a full bladder, got a full stomach. Those are baroreceptors that tell your brain of the stretch in those areas. We'll talk a lot about baroreceptors in Bio211. Let's see, chemoreceptors, proprio of course are listed there again. And then finally, chemoreceptors are going to detect chemical changes in your bloodstream, pH, oxygen, carbon dioxide. So we're gonna talk a lot about those as well in Bio211. I promised you that last page was a lot easier. So that is it for this chapter. Okay, so the test on Monday runs through page 125. I'd like to open the floor to you now for questions.
The brain.
Brain, okay, what specifically?
The cerebral spine.
CSF flow, okay. Just want to hear it again, or?
No, actually, go over this.
Oh, the spinal cord cross section, sure.
Yep.
Just walk you through it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let's head back and talk about spinal cord cross-section. Okay, this is bottom of page 105. You're looking at a cross-section of the spinal cord, which is actually central nervous system. And you're looking at the spinal nerve here, which is actually peripheral nervous system. So we're getting a snapshot of both systems here combined in together. Let's talk about the white matter and gray matter first. In the spinal cord, the white matter, is it superficial or deep? White matter is?
Superficial.
Yeah, superficial out here. And the thing that looks like a butterfly inside, that's actually gray matter, so it's deep to the white matter. Just want to make that point because in the brain we've got a reverse scenario. In the brain, the gray matter is actually superficial. So let's take the gray matter first. These gray matter portions are called horns. The pieces sticking toward the backside are called dorsal or posterior horns. At the sides, we've got lateral horns, and down below, we've got ventral or anterior horns. All right, so which of these three horns houses interneurons? Dorsal, good. Dorsal horns house interneurons. What is the job of an interneuron?
Communicate between sensory and motor.
Good. Communicates between sensory and motor. So the lateral and the ventral horn both play a role in motor output. One of these is a visceral or autonomic horn. The other is a somatic or a voluntary horn. So where would you control, say, skeletal muscles from? Ventral. Good. So what's colored red there is going to be our ventral horn that controls voluntary skeletal muscles. We call it the somatic nervous system horn. The lateral horn there in yellow, what does it control?
Cardiac.
Cardiac smooth. It is autonomic nervous system motor control. So all those involuntary events originate there in that lateral horn of the gray matter. So whether you're talking lateral horn or ventral horn, that information travels out this ventral root. It joins with the dorsal root and becomes a spinal nerve. and then it travels on to its destination, wherever that may be. Sensory information comes in the backside. It comes in this dorsal root, and the way to spot the dorsal root is to look for what landmark?
Ganglion.
The ganglion, good. So what is a ganglion? Cell bodies, good. Collection of cell bodies. So right there is our dorsal root ganglion. It's a collection of cell bodies, and that is going to give us a good idea of the backside of this picture from the front side. So what type of information is housed in your dorsal root? Sensory. Yes, sensory information comes in. In fact, it is both automatic or autonomic and somatic. So you've got both types, voluntary and involuntary information, coming into those interneurons. Now, if information is to be carried up to your brain, information will come in from your dorsal root, hit the interneuron, and travel across this bridge here, known as?
Gray
commissure. Good. Then we will hit the appropriate portion of your white matter. We're going to hit an ascending tract that goes where?
To the brain,
right. So what kind of information is carried in an ascending tract?
Sensory,
good. And so the brain makes a decision, and when we come back down the spinal cord, we travel in which kind of tract?
Descending,
good. Descending tracts house what information? Motor, good. And so we may come right back down across that gray commissure. If the information is to move a skeletal muscle, which horn do we come from? The ventral horn, good. So right back out that ventral root, head out that spinal nerve into the appropriate part of your body. Okay, so we call this kind of control from left side of the body to the opposite hemisphere of the brain. Contralateral, good, that's contralateral control, okay? Now, if we're talking a reflex here, we don't necessarily need to go to the brain to tell the brain what happened. Reflexes can come in a dorsal root and right back out a ventral root. If there is only one synapse involved, we call that reflex what? Poly or monosynaptic?
Mono.
Yeah, and if there's multiple synapses involved in the reflex arc, it's poly, good. So something like, a withdrawal reflex, where you flex away from a hot object or a poke of a pen, what do we classify that one as? It's poly, yeah, that just happens to be a polysynaptic reflex, okay. So reflexes don't have to go to the brain. All they do is route into the spinal cord and then right back out. You know, the brain eventually may be notified as to what happened, but the reflex moves you away from a point of a stimulus very quickly, whatever that stimulus may be. Okay, how about questions on the spinal cord cross section? Any of the parts of the spinal cord or spinal nerve? Monosynaptic is like a stretch reflex, you know, where you automatically contract in response. Like if you stretch your legs in the bed and you get a Charlie horse.
What was it called when you said something about you don't go to the interneuron, you go straight to the lateral?
If you come from dorsal root, bypass the interneuron, and come straight back out, that's a monosynaptic reflex pathway. So that's the fastest type we've got. Poly goes to the interneuron and then goes to the appropriate horn of those two and then comes back out. Yeah. What else would you like to review? Anything in this chapter since we're on the spinal cord and spinal nerve chapter? What part? Sure. Just run back through the whole flow path. Okay. All right, so let's do cerebrospinal fluid circulation in your course pack. This is page 111. first thing I want to mention is that cerebrospinal fluid is kind of like blood. You know, blood has blood cells and blood plasma in it, but when we're circulating cerebrospinal fluid, we don't want to circulate the blood cells. We simply want to circulate some of the fluid, electrolytes. We want to take the glucose, and we want to circulate that stuff through the brain tissue. So we squeeze across the wall of our capillaries in the brain this stuff called filtrate that becomes our cerebrospinal fluid. That cerebrospinal fluid is what's circulating throughout our ventricles, inside the brain, down the central canal of the spinal cord, and on the outside surfaces in the subarachnoid space. So this fluid is great at nourishing the brain and spinal cord, and it also picks up waste products that will eventually return to blood flow. So where do we make cerebrospinal fluid? What are these knots of capillaries called? Choroid plexus, good. So choroid plexuses are in a few locations. I'm just going to pick the ones in our lateral ventricles as our starting point. So we squeeze the fluid out of the blood capillaries, and we get this clear, colorless fluid called cerebrospinal fluid. And we circulate that through the two lateral ventricles here on either side of the hemispheres of the brain. From those lateral ventricles, we pass through a small opening here, a tiny hole. That hole is called what? Good. Interventricular foramen. And from there, we just keep heading down through a third ventricle, through a very narrow passageway called the cerebral aqueduct. And then where next? Fourth ventricle. Good. From there, we continue down to the spinal cord. This time, we're inside the spinal cord in the central canal. And then we travel all the way to the bottom of the spinal cord where we exit. Now, what layer of the coverings are we in? Subarachnoid space, right. So we travel outside the spinal cord in that subarachnoid space. We even travel outside the brain in the subarachnoid space. And we eventually get reabsorbed back into the blood flow through these little out pockets here called arachnoid villi. Okay? And so that fluid gets pulled back into the bloodstream in a big vessel called what? Dural sinuses. Yeah, and you can have, say, superior sagittal sinus or transverse sinus picking up that fluid from the circulation pattern. Okay? So once we're back in the blood flow, that's it for our CSF circulation pattern. We've now returned waste products and other items back into the bloodstream. Probably one of the easiest things to do if you're still in the process of learning this one is to sit with a picture like this one here, and you'll notice that we just travel from the lateral ventricles, which coil into each hemisphere, and you just work your way down. Okay, so it's lateral ventricles, interventricular foramen. What is next?
Third
ventricle, and then what's next? Good, then fourth ventricle, and then central canal. And then we finally exit and go outside in the subarachnoid space. And then where do we get reabsorbed? Yeah, arachnoid villi or granulations into those dural sinuses. Good. Okay. So that one's a guarantee for the essays on Monday's test. You know, you can choose that one. That will at least knock off one of your three essays. All you have to do is list it. Just start with choroid plexuses and then get us back into blood flow up there at the dural sinus. Do you have any questions on CSF circulation? Carolyn, that put it for you. Okay.
I have a question.
Sure.
Do we have to write like that it's being reabsorbed back, or can we just like write down dural sinuses?
Just write dural sinuses. I know that's your last step. What's your next question?
Can you talk about anything else that might be a discussion question that you
could review? Those spinal cord that we just went over, you know, lateral horns, ventral horns, I will sometimes say, you know, you've got damage to one of those horns, predict the problems that may result. So, you know, you're looking at cardiac or smooth muscle or skeletal muscle being impaired. So I look at those horns. I also look at sympathetic versus parasympathetic. So I might give you a scenario and ask you what's happened, and then tell me which system is in control. So those are typical ones that I'll ask. I've asked monosynaptic versus polysynaptic reflexes before. Do expect that picture of the spinal cord that we just went through to be on there, the brain's on there. So pictures that we spent time labeling, those are on there.
There, like the one that you had, one you gave us that was just blank.
I don't have that one hand labeled. I can label it and put it up there for you, though.
Because I have mine from last semester, so it's labeled differently than what you.
Probably the best one is, let me see. This is the brain PowerPoint. This one's labeled pretty well. It's got almost everything that we've covered in terms of the cerebrum. So that's probably a pretty good one to use. Okay, how about your next question? Okay, so cerebrum has four lobes. Which lobe houses visual information? Good. Which lobe houses, voluntary motor control? Frontal lobe, good. Which lobe houses somatic sensory input? Parietal, good. Taste? Parietal, good. How about personality?
Frontal.
Frontal, good. Which hemisphere houses speech for most of us?
Left,
good. Which hemisphere houses general interpretation? Still the left, yeah. Let's say, which hemisphere tends to favor things like reading and logic? Still the left. Yeah. What about spatial orientation? Now you're on the right. Okay, so left hemisphere does a lot, doesn't it? Be a bad hemisphere to lose, it sounds like. So speech, general interpretation, reading, logic, math, science, these are all types of things housed in that left hemisphere. Okay, which specific portion of your frontal lobe houses the primary motor cortex? Precentral gyrus, good. What separates your precentral gyrus from your postcentral gyrus?
Central sulcus.
Central sulcus, good. What separates your left hemisphere from your right hemisphere? Longitudinal fissure, good. What separates your cerebrum from your cerebellum? Transverse fissure, good. That's the line back there, good. Let's see. Which lobe houses smell?
Temporal
lobe, good. Let's see. If you are talking about the sensation of touch or cold on your skin, where specifically does that go? Postcentral gyrus, good. And what sensory portion is housed there? Somatic, yeah, somatic sensory, good. And which part of your diencephalon routes that information to the somatic sensory cortex? Thalamus, good. Thalamus routes it, good. Okay. These are commonly missed. I just want to make sure I hit this too. We talked about fiber types in the brain. I just want to make sure we go back and review that also. What type of fibers carry information across from the left to the right hemisphere and vice versa? Association. Yep, association. corpus callosum is an association set of fibers.
Do you know where pectus is from?
Yeah, it's on the bottom. Association is left to right. I'm sorry, commissural. Yes.
No, wait a minute.
Commissural is corpus callosum. That's left to right. Let's talk association. What does it do?
That's a single.
Yeah, that's going to run the single length of your left hemisphere front to back or right hemisphere front to back. And then the final type, which was in this previous picture, comes up through the thalamus and radiates out to the appropriate portion of your cerebral cortex is
projection.
Yep. So association or the length, commissural are left and right, projection project out onto the appropriate part of your cortex. How about other brain or spinal cord questions? How many pairs of spinal nerves?
31.
31. How many cranial nerve pairs? 12. Good. Spinal nerves are considered mixed nerves. What does that mean?
Motor
and sensory. Good. Cranial nerves are motor or sensory or both. Good. Okay. How about questions from chapter 14? Anything from autonomic or somatic nervous systems? Y'all done? Okay. If you need anything, feel free to email me. I will check email throughout the weekend. Don't forget those quizzes close on Monday at 11. Good luck studying.
Thank you.